Cool.
Ready.
Thanks for joining us. Yeah. Thanks for doing this. Let's start at the beginning of Siren Biotechnology.
I know.
You raised $6 million, moved into an incubator, incubator space with Bayer. And you got your startup running in just a few weeks. That was in the middle of COVID. Tell us the story. How did it happen?
So we had this project in my lab that back then we lovingly referred to as like the Universal Payloads Project.
Universal Payloads Project. Okay.
All kind of founded around the idea of trying to make a single AAV gene therapy that could be used to treat more than one thing. We weren't, when we started the project, we weren't laser focused, like, oh, this is going to be an oncology company.
Yeah.
This was super academic and was very like, you know, 40,000 feet in the clouds and was just like, could you make an AAV gene therapy that could treat more than one thing? And then fast forward all these years of work and it ended up becoming an oncology project and ended up becoming a company and all of these things. But
yeah, I will have many questions about universal gene therapies.
Oh yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. And really, like, the impetus for starting Siren was COVID itself. And it's not because we were a virology lab and I was a virology professor. Like, none of that. It was out of, like, spite and frustration.
Spite and frustration.
if folks, right, take your, like, close your eyes and take yourself back to, like, the beginning of COVID.
I've repressed it all.
Where, like, you just, right, you just got told on that Thursday, all of a sudden, like, you have to go home and you have to, like, lock yourself up and you can't come out and we're going to, sure, maybe this is going to be like a whole month.
Yeah, don't worry. We'll flatten the curve after a month.
Yeah. And we were all like, oh, okay, this is going to be like 30 days and then it will be over. Wasn't that cute? Right. So it was like in that moment, we like, we're just hitting like the zenith of this project. It was just really starting to hit. And we had like all these in vivo studies and it was amazing.
But a purely academic project.
Purely academic.
Okay.
Like, the company was not even in our mind. And then COVID hit and we were like, okay, 30 days, like this will be fine. And then it became like the second month and the third month and the fourth month and the fifth month, right? And we are, or back then we were, you know, a very, very, very like, in-person lab, right? Mm-hmm. We were not phoning this in terms of, you know, we have like this big, huge bioinformatic team that can work remotely. Like,
sure,
we are, every single person in the lab was like doing mouse work in the surgical suites, needing to be in the tissue culture room. So absolutely nothing was happening to advance the project. So we were like reanalyzing old data, writing grants and reviews, but like nothing on the project was advancing. It was just completely stalled.
And you couldn't get permission to like go back in.
Couldn't get permission to go back in unless we said that we would pivot the lab to working on COVID. And I was like, no, even though like as a virology professor, I'm just like, this is like a BSL-2 agent. It's like so chill. like, I don't know why everybody's freaking out. Like, we can work in this in our sleep. But I didn't want to pivot the lab because I knew if we did, it would be like a permanent, it would end up becoming like this permanent thing. And I didn't want to cave. So I was like, I don't want to pivot into COVID. I want to keep working on the project we were working on. And so we just like kept saying no. And so we weren't allowed back.
Oh, interesting. So only if you're doing COVID research or something kind
exactly
of this healthcare.
Even if you were
related,
a like virology lab, yeah, if you weren't working on COVID, you couldn't come back, right? Because we were
essential workers, a public thing. Yeah.
Right. We were a public university and beholden to the, you know, the state rules. And, you know, unlike our colleagues down at Stanford, right, private university, just 20 minutes away, they were able to come back because they were able to kind of set their own rules.
Oh.
We were a public institution at UCSF, and so we were kind of beholden to the state legislative rules and could not come back. And it was like, I think it was like month 6, 7, 8, 9, like don't quote me on the exact one, but many months into this being at home, when we just, the frustration just started to hit this level that was like, this is crazy. And, you know, that was when, remember when folks were allowed to start coming back to places like this for like 5% occupancy,
oh,
or
sure,
10% occupancy.
Yeah.
And it was like, it's like one person could be in the tissue culture hood at a time. And that meant we still couldn't do surgeries on animals because the surgeries actually require two people to be present for safety reasons.
Oh, yikes.
So it's like we still couldn't. It was just like, how do we get this up and going so we could kind of keep back up? And all of my friends that had startups out in industry, they were like, oh, well, we're essential workers. We can just come back. And I was like, what if I just temporarily
start a company?
Just so that we could get back to work on this project. So the thought was never like, oh, I'm going to become the next Genentech. We're going to make this huge epic company. It was like, oh, what if we just like temporarily started a company
to get back to work?
Right. And there were incubators like literally on campus and even across the street that were meant for faculty spinouts. And so I was like, well, what if I started a company and kind of talked to some folks in the department and they're like, you can't use your NIH grant money. And I'm like, yeah, of course. I would have to go like raise actual VC dollars. And they're like, yeah, but that's like a whole endeavor. You don't just up and do something like that. I was like, yeah, but like assume I could.
Yeah.
If I could raise some money, like could I start a company and could we keep going back to work? And they're like, oh my God, we hate this. But like, yes, you could do this. We hate it, but you could, but you would have to go like jump through all of these hoops and, you know, you need permits from the city and the county and the state and all. I'm like, yeah. But like, assume I did all that. Could I start a company? And they're like, yes. And so then I had my marching orders and I just like pinged a bunch of VCs that I had been doing diligence for already. And was like, hey, what if I sent you something? Would you do it? Would you take a look at it? And as luck would have it, a bunch of them said yes. And we kind of threw together a pitch. This was not like we prepared for a year, this epic pitch deck and data room. We like threw together some slides and managed to get like Founders Fund and Lux Capital and like some of these like marquee investors.
Firms. Yeah.
And they were like, if you do this, but like, you have to leave and do it. Like, this is not like you can, I'm going to take a little quarter long sabbatical or I'm going to take leave for a little bit and just like be the interim CEO. Like if you're going to do this, we will back it. And so that was kind of the impetus to start Siren, is that they were only willing to write the checks if we left and like really, really did this.
Oh, wow. That's an amazing.
So Siren, I don't think would have been here if it wasn't for COVID.
Wow.
So there's like one good thing that came out of that whole terrible situation.
Let's talk about this universal gene therapy concept for a second. So most gene therapies, they're bespoke for each disease. Can you just tell us like, what is a universal gene therapy and why isn't it why isn't it just a moonshot? Like why is it a necessary thing? Why do we have to have it for gene therapy to succeed?
So every gene therapy on Earth, whether it's in an academic lab, it's in like some big government consortia, it's out in a tiny startup, it's in a big, huge startup, it's in big pharma, doesn't matter where we're talking about, every one of those AAV gene therapies, AAV just being like the leading virus that we use to perform gene therapy, every one of those on Earth is bespoke for one disease, meaning like, I'm going to make this AAV gene therapy and it treats hemophilia B. And I obviously then can't use it to treat a little girl who has spinal muscular atrophy because like the genetic medicine, the payload that we're putting inside the virus is specific for that disease. So they're all bespoke, not at an individual patient level, the way that like a CAR T cell therapy is like made from you, for you, by you, with your cells, but it's for just one disease.
So I mean, every company is like having to do a lot of foundational AAV kind of like re-engineering from scratch.
Exactly. And so I sit on a lot of scientific advisory boards, public and private. I don't even know the number anymore. It's a lot. and I kept getting asked to sit in the same whiteboard meeting, whether it's a public company with like 10,000 employees or a little teeny tiny stealth startup with like two people and a dream, or every size company in between. They have their like foundational IP, like the thing that they've decided to start the company on, like whether that's like a new capsid or a new promoter or a new synthetic circuit or some fundamental biology that they've uncovered that allows them to like target something in an interesting way. Like they have some cookie, something that makes them special. And then they're like, okay, we have this cookie. And now we want to start a gene therapy company with this cookie to like go after X.
Are you like the AAV person? Everyone like points
exactly.
To like,
so everyone's
go,
like,
go
oh,
talk
we want to use AAV. So let's bring her in. And then you have like that very first meeting. And it's like you and the founder and maybe like one other SAB member and maybe like the initial scientist or founding engineer or whatever. And you're having that whiteboard meeting and you're like, okay, first meeting, like, what do you guys need? What's up? And they're like, what should we go after? And you're like, okay, what do you have? And you start walking through this process and all of a sudden they're like, okay, well, we have a new, whatever it is, like I said, one of those component parts. And they're like, but we need all the other component parts. So like if they have a new capsid, they're like, okay, well, now we need a promoter and we need a payload and we need a whatever. And so all of a sudden they're like, well, we don't want to pay licenses for a promoter and a backbone and a payload and a capsid and a manufacturing platform and a purification platform and a delivery route and a delivery administrator, you know, like all of these things. We want to own all of that. we want to like have the entire tech stack. We want to have all of it so we're not paying milestones. We don't have to deal with all this. And like, wouldn't it be so cool to like own all of it? And I'm like, okay, well, it went from you're 2 years out from the clinic to now you're like six years out from the clinic and you don't need to raise $50 million. You need to raise $500 million. And like all of a sudden, like it's just ballooned into this massive thing, which not that it won't work, not that's not important, not that you shouldn't do it, but like this is a categorically different set of needs.
Maybe crawl, walk, run. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, it didn't matter if they were a teeny tiny startup or they were a huge already public company and they're just like, what's going to be our fourth gene therapy that we add to our pipeline? Everyone wanted to build the whole thing from scratch, but it all usually stemmed from the fact that they're like, well, no matter what, we have to change the payload. Mm-hmm. Because no matter what, these are only ever used to treat Mendelian monogenic disorders where you're just missing one copy of one gene or there's a mutation in just one gene.
So it's like an economic reason they want to do it or like a not invented here issue, like whatever.
All by all. It was just like, well, no matter what, the payload has to change. So since we have to innovate that anyways, why don't we also come up with like, let's queue up a capsid engineering team and a promoter engineering team and a backbone engineering team. Mm. And why don't we queue up like our own in-house GMP manufacturing facility out in Minnesota that costs $500 million? And it was like, oh, it's just like,
sounds expensive.
And it all always stemmed from, well, no matter what, we have to change the payload. Mm. So I was like, well, what if we just like scratch at that, like poke at that? Like, what if you didn't have to change the payload? What if you had a payload that could be used to treat more than one thing? What if you could make a gene therapy that could treat two diseases or 20 or 200? And you just had like the exact same drug product that nothing changed. The payload, the promoter, the backbone, the capsid, the manufacturing. Like it is this exact same like vial of AAV gene therapy that you're going to use for all these different. Like, could that be possible? Because then that would be a way that we could short circuit a lot of the time challenges, the amount of capital that you need, the amount of space that you need, the amount of people that you need, the amount of regulatory burden. It was just like all of the challenges that the entire field is facing all stemmed from this very seemingly very simple, like, well, we just have to change the payload every time. But it would always manifest as this, well, let's reinvent the whole wheel from scratch for every one of these programs. And so we just kind of wanted to poke that bear and be like, well, what if we just didn't do that? What if we came up with one AAV gene therapy that could treat many things? Then maybe you only need to raise $50 million all in to go from zero to one, zero being concept, one being FDA-approved drug that people can go get a prescription for. What if all you need to raise is like $50 million and you could do the whole thing in like 5 to 6 years and you kind of get rid of the, well, it's going to take $2 billion and it's going to take 15 million years and it's going to take, you know, three separate clinical trials and all of these things.
So scientifically, how does that work?
How do you actually do
it
that?
Sounds great.
We kind of like took a step back and we're just like, okay, what, like, is there anything you could put inside a virus that could treat more than one thing? Like, what are things that do things of interest, you know, modulate cell signaling, cell interactions, cell behavior, cell states, these types of things that work in adults and kids and in different developmental time points and in different tissues and in different disease states? Kind of started making a list of things that we're interested in. So things like transcription factors and cytokines and things that modulate like cell-cell adhesion and protein degradation, like just like fundamental things, and just started testing them both alone and in combination with each other. And again, had no like grand vision. Like, we're pointing this at oncology. We were just like very broadly like thinking about this.
And is this still pre-startup academia or in?
Is this still pre-startup academia?
Okay.
And then started kind of like narrowing down to ones that started to look interesting. And very soon we realized we were very interested in the ones that had cytokines. So we had all these engineered cytokines that we were packaging inside of AAVs. And we're like, man, these are really interesting because they're very pleiotropic, right? Cytokines have activity in like oncology and autoimmunity and infectious diseases and just all kinds of things in the body. And so we're like, these probably have the most legs. And then at that moment is when we kind of decided to spin out. Still didn't have like a name development candidate, still weren't that far along yet, but realized that like the engineered cytokines and oncology setting was probably a good place. We were just heads down for like 3 years figuring out like, okay, which one of these, and like, let's start innovating. Since again, we're only going to do this process once, where we do want to innovate on all those component parts, including the payload, and do it once and then not again. Like, this is going to be our universal asset. We're not going to queue up 10 assets. This is the asset.
And so is the idea just with going back to the cytokines, like, is it by playing with like dose and delivery could actually treat a bunch of different diseases? Did I get that right?
Yeah. So the nice thing about these cytokines, and it kind of, I don't want to say it doesn't matter which cytokine you're using. It obviously does. But the nice thing about cytokines, right? Like, they're basically just retraining your immune system to fight cancer. Like, your immune system is fantastic. Like,
yep.
As we are talking right now, we both have a tumor.
Yep. It's gone.
We've had every day of our lives.
Yep.
Right? It was an individual cell, and your body is doing like basal background cancer immunosurveillance mediated by the healthy cells around that tumor cell that are sending out little cytokine signals to your immune system and saying, like, come run an investigation on this like super suspicious guy over here.
Yep.
And your immune system's like gets that little signal, that beacon, that siren, hence the name of the company. Mm-hmm. And it comes to the site and it's like, I agree. I ran an investigation. I don't like this cell. It's suspicious. I'm gonna chew it up. So you can use these as tools to kind of re-engineer your immune system, and basically just using viruses as the delivery truck rather than delivering cytokines themselves, which have a half-life of like single-digit minutes in some cases. The virus itself has no anti-cancer activity.
Yep.
It's just an engineerable FedEx truck to deliver packages, and the package happens to be the cancer drug.
I love that. So you've built your career chasing kind of bold ideas that people might not always touch. So I heard in grad school, your PhD advisor warned you not to go into gene therapy.
Yeah.
I think it might've been a moment. Gene therapy's had some moments where it's not been as popular.
Yeah, it was not popular. Yeah. That's for sure.
instead, he tried to tell you to work on stem cells, which were all the rage at the moment.
Oh yeah.
But you went and found funding for gene therapy anyway and started a gene therapy project anyway. Like what gave you that conviction? What's your secret to spotting opportunities early and winning over the skeptics?
So that was an interesting story. So my undergrad was in medical microbiology. So I was already super pumped on like the concept of studying viruses. But that was more like, let's study like hemorrhagic fever viruses. So things like Ebola and Marburg and just like these, you know, one in a zillion rare viruses that are just super fun, not to get, but to study. you don't want to get them. It'd be awful. But was already kind of a virologist at heart and knew I wanted to do something with that, and then joined this lab and was kind of already enamored at the idea of using viruses as medicines. Had like read a little bit about gene therapy and was just like, this just seems so cool.
And this was
so engineerable.
Are we talking like early 2000s, mid-2000s?
Yeah, so this is like early 2000s.
So we've kind of had our first gene therapy false start, maybe a couple false starts already at this point.
Timing-wise, there was stuff happening in academia, but there wasn't really a lot. I mean, there were no commercial gene therapies yet. But there were companies that had like were kind of existing, but they were kind of stealth. It was not like a big thing yet. So like, for example, the big gene therapy society, the American Society for Gene and Cell Therapy, it's now called Cell and Gene.
Yeah. Jeez, it sounds, it doesn't roll the tongue.
But it used to be American Society of Gene Therapy. So it used to be ASGT, and then we added the C like decades later. So back then ASGT was a thing, but it was like 300 people.
Got it.
You know, now it's like 10,000 or something.
Was it like viewed as like a fringe academic thing at the time?
It was just like, you know, academics being academics, like they're just geeking out, they're doing cool stuff, they're geeking. And I was really enamored with the idea of using viruses to do something cool, maybe something that was a medicine, and knew that gene therapy roughly existed. And I joined this lab, Marcus Grumpy's lab at OHSU, and he was like director of the Oregon Stem Cell Center and like the stem cell advisor to the president of like the United States, and was just like stem cells.
So it's funny that the president has a stem cell advisor.
And you know, it was just stem cells are life. And I was just like, but what if I did something with viruses? And he's just like, no, like, where's a stem cell at? What are you talking about? You work on stem cells. It's the coolest thing on earth. Why wouldn't you want to study stem cells? And I was like, I don't want to study viruses. And he's just like, I can't fund you. Like, and like almost kind of as a joke, he was just like, I mean, if you go find some money, like I would, I guess, let you. But like,
it sounds just like you're starting a company story.
Exactly. He was like, I mean, if you go find some money or something, but like otherwise, like I've got all these grants to study stem cells. I need to pay you to study stem cells. And again, I was just like, all right, I've got my marching orders.
It sounds like there's a chance.
I went out and, like, you know, out of spite, I was just like, I'm gonna find some money. And went out and got like every last scholarship and fellowship and grant that you could possibly apply for, including ones that, like, I wasn't even technically eligible for. And they were like, wait, you're not a professor? And I'm like, no, I'm like a first year grad student. I haven't even done quals yet. And they're just like,
what?
But you won. I mean, I guess we can't take it back from you now. So, all right, here's the grant.
So you got grants, whether angels, philanthropies, patient, like, sounds like a lot of different sources.
Yeah, so we kind of cobbled a bunch of money together from everywhere. And then he was just like, all right, fine, play in the corner with viruses. But then, because the field wasn't very popular yet, it was still just kind of like this nascent starting field. There was all this fundamental stuff that just was kind of ready to be done. And so there wasn't a lot of competition because the field didn't really exist yet. And it wasn't super popular. So I lucked out and, like, we just started publishing like crazy because there was just all this obvious stuff to do, like all these fundamentals. I think I published like 6 papers in like 3 years or something.
Oh, wow.
And
did he like viruses after that?
That, right, after the first couple, he was like, I mean, okay. Because, you know, papers are currency in academia. So he was just like, okay, you found some money and we're publishing really well. So, like, let's keep this up. And so then, like, about halfway through my PhD, he was like, go for it. Yeah, just like all in.
It's like, we love viruses.
Let's go.
Now.
We love viruses. And it was also right at about that moment where we were like on a roll and the publications were really coming at a pretty fast clip. It was right at that moment that was also kind of like, I think everyone heard the word gene therapy for the first time. It was kind of when it hit. And, you know, like your parents probably had heard of it at that point. It was like, it had made like the 5 o'clock news and it was on like NBC. They were like, gene therapy companies are starting to infuse humans with viruses. And that was like the data from Spark Therapeutics for Luxturna's, right? The one that ended up becoming the first US FDA approved gene therapy and all these types of things. And so it was like, right as I was finishing my PhD and getting ready to start my postdoc down at Stanford was when gene therapy like hit. But again, it hadn't been super popular.
Sure.
So there wasn't a lot of people ahead of me. Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Like a well-trodden, well-built field. And so the field was kind of wide open. And so I got to start my postdoc and then my academic lab at UCSF, where there was, I mean, maybe a dozen of us on the planet that were like, you know, the famous ones.
Yeah.
But not a really big, deep field. And so we kind of got to have an outsized impact despite the fact that there weren't that many of us.
That's so cool. And a lot of people, first year PhD students, would probably just say like, oh, you're right. I should just do what the lab is doing. Like, what do you think like made you keep going on it? Just stubbornness?
Just a combination of stubbornness.
Passion,
and just being like a big geeky nerd who's just like, this is so cool though. Like, it's viruses and they're so engineerable. And like, you know, when you're here in Silicon Valley, right? And you know, everyone's in zeros and ones, and it's just like viruses are very similar to that. It's very similar to coding. They're just super engineerable. It's just instead of zeros and ones, right? It's A's, T's, G's, and C's, but they're very engineerable. It's like little synthetic circuits that you can just kind of like program and do Boolean logic and all this kind of stuff.
Do you think going out and getting all that money from all those different kind of alternative sources like did something like shaped you in like an interesting way?
Maybe.
Where you'd be like you had to go, you were fundraising back then.
Maybe I was destined to be a CEO and I just never knew it.
Yeah. You were fundraising back then as a first year grad student.
I mean, it definitely taught you like how to talk to all these different groups.
Yeah.
Because like how you talk to a disease foundation is super different than how you talk to the NIH, which is super different than how you talk to a VC, which is super different than how you talk to an angel and like all of these things.
And you got that lesson first year of grad school. I think that's like a really powerful thing.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I guess I haven't thought about it in that way, but yeah, it probably set me up to be a lot better at talking to folks. And like one of my favorite types of talks, whether I'm pitching or not, is talks for generalists. So some of the most popular talks I have ever given are not my like hoity-toity, you know, presidential symposium talk at this big scientific medical conference, which are fun and those are great and I love doing them. But the best talks I've ever given, the ones with like the best reception and the ones with like the most views and the most everything, are the ones for generalists, where you're just giving a talk like super high level about a concept. Like, let me explain to you about what it means to use a virus to deliver medicine. Not like, let me get into the nitty gritty of my statistics on my little plot here. Can you, as a scientist, like, could you, I think if you ask the average scientist, could you give an hour long talk, 60 minutes, which is a very long time.
It's a lot of talking.
Could you give a 60 minute talk with no slides or with slides, but they're not allowed to have any data on them and like get people engaged and still willing to sit there for that hour?
That's a totally different science. That is a totally different skill.
Is a very different skill, but it's, if you can do that, I would argue that you know how to like meet people where they are. Mm-hmm. Whether that's like, is this a hardcore biotech New York like private equity firm that does nothing but late stage biotech investing, like they are going to want to hear a very different story than a generalist talk that's 20 minutes, that's like on a big stage, you know, like South by Southwest or something. Like, those are two very different groups. Mm-hmm. And knowing how to give each of those talks, I think comes from, I think, A, being a good professor, which is also like knowing how to talk to people and how to educate them and how to get them excited. And I think that translated well into being a CEO in a way that I don't think people appreciate, because there's a lot of like poo-pooing academic spinouts and like, oh, it's an academic founder. Oh, they're going to be terrible. And I think that can be true. There are occasionally academics.
They're also terrible non-academic founders.
Of course. Yeah, there's terrible founders.
There's a lot of terrible founders.
but I think the gut reaction, the gut assumption that someone coming from academia is like inherently going to be a bad founder or a bad CEO or a bad CSO because they just don't get it. I would push back on that and say not necessarily. I think sometimes my time in academia could not possibly have been a better kind of tee up for being a good CEO.
Speaking of academia, let's talk a little bit more about grants. One thing you've said is no matter what's happening in the market, grants will always be there. I don't think anyone could have predicted quite how much things
it is technically still true.
How much things have changed. Is pursuing research grants still worth it, in your opinion, for early stage startups?
Without a doubt, unquestionably. I can't imagine a world where you aren't writing grants. And I think absolutely everybody should, whether it's a federal grant, a state grant, one from a disease society or foundation, from a vendor, from you name it, from a global huge entity. Grants have this amazing ability to like force you to laser focus and actually think through your idea before you get started.
So it forces you to write a narrative.
It forces you to write a whole narrative, not just like, this is what I'm gonna use the money for. Like, these are my three scientific, my specific aims. It's not just the aims. It's like you have to build an entire story around, why is this needed? Why is it important? Why right now? Why am I uniquely suited to this? And then also all the nitty gritty, like here are the exact experiments I'm going to run. And here's like the study designs and the numbers of animals and like the reagents I'm going to need.
Actually not that different from like a pitch deck.
Yeah. Exactly. But like a way more nuanced detail, right? It's an entire data room, but in grant form. Mm-hmm. So it's a narrative story of like an entire corporate pitch. Like, tell me your 5-year, you know, corporate plan, but like written in a different way. It's written in grant form.
So you're saying like always applying for grants is a good way of just like forcing you to do that thinking exercise and keep updating the company's kind of narrative.
Exactly. So like, you know, when someone asks me like, what would you, you know, what's going to be your use of capital? And then I'm like, I can tell you down to the dollar what I'm going to be using all of that money for, because I've actually specced it out. Not just theoretically, like, oh, I've heard that running an IND enabling animal study costs $2 million. Now, I can tell you because I have quoted it out with the exact vendors we would use, and I know the exact study designs, and I know the exact number of tissues that we would harvest, and at what time points. And like, it just gives you a level of granularity that is kind of impossible to do without having done that exercise. And it also allows you to see blind spots, not just in the experiments, but for your company. It's kind of like you know, like even in academia, right? The best papers are the ones like you pre-write the paper before you start. Like, mm-hmm. Think to the end.
Yeah.
What's the,
these are my
what
figures.
Are the,
yeah.
What are the figures going to be in this Nature paper? And everything else is just noise. And it might be something interesting, but I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole. I'm going to stay laser focused on what I actually got to do, particularly in this market where, like, ain't no one going to give you money to run your cute little side experiments. You got to stay laser focused on, like, what are the near term de-risking milestones you got to do to, like, keep inching this thing towards the clinic. And I think there is no more clarifying thing than writing it all down. But rather than, like, journaling it, which isn't going to do you very much, you might as well write a grant and
get some money for
maybe
it.
Maybe you get some non-dilutive money. I mean, I think we're up to maybe $5 million that we've brought in non-dilutive money already to date.
That's amazing. That's very high ROI journaling.
So it's like a lot, that's like a meaningful amount of money. If it was 50 grand, it's like, okay, that's not even one animal
study.
$5 million is like...
That's a seed Series A for most companies.
Yeah. You can do a lot with $5 million bucks.
Totally. Let's talk about crowdfunding.
Yeah,
so
crazy stuff, fun stuff.
Earlier, you became the first therapeutics company maybe ever to crowdfund.
It might be.
Yeah, and you raised $1 million in the first week. Also a substantial sum of money. And I think it's like $2.5 million total
just
pulled in
it,
from it. And consistently in sort of like one of the, you know, top raising campaigns nationwide across all industries, not just biotech.
Yeah.
You already have sort of like, I don't know if blue chip is the right term, but like very legitimate investors like Founders Fund and Lux who invested, and not a huge precedent for doing this in biotech.
Exactly.
And honestly, like in some people probably have like a slight negative perception of crowdfunding.
Absolutely.
Like, why'd you do it? Why was it so important to
you? So it kind of happens in Silicon Valley tech, but definitely not in biotech. So a private company can raise up to $5 million every 12 months from non-accredited investors just every year. That's like totally allowed for a private company to do. And like, I just categorically didn't believe it. Like, had to call our corporate counsel. I'm like,
am I going to jail if I do this?
Is this really a thing? Like, can you do this as a private company? And they're like, yeah, it's just not done. It's just not normal, but it is a thing you can do. And I was just like, well, we have to run this experiment. Like, now the scientist in me was just peaked. I was just like,
did you feel like there were like $100 bills on the ground? You're like, why isn't anyone picking them up?
Kind of. Yeah. I was just, well, I didn't know if it would work. Cause again, there wasn't really a path of like card carrying therapeutics companies. There are many companies that have raised using this platform and this mechanism called RegCF, but they just weren't therapeutics companies. Like, and it was really about just kind of running the experiment to see, could anybody be interested in a therapeutics company given the kind of timelines? And kind of the second order layer was, man, wouldn't it be cool if we brought a bunch of patients onto the cap table? And I say this with all the love in my heart for our institutional VCs, like, love you. None of this would be possible without you. Super thankful for all of them. But if you asked me, like, who do you want on your cap table? And I'm like, I would want, like, patients. I would want the people who are going to be there with you no matter how dark and scary it gets, because they're like, we personally need this to work. Like, I am going to back you and be here and excited for you. And like, we will figure out a way, like, you know, whatever, you hit some roadblock, there's some regulatory challenge,
they will be long-term believers.
You know, it's the long-term believers. Like, they are in it to win it because it matters to them personally, because they have that disease, whether it's, you know, cancer or cardiovascular disease or diabetes or like whatever it is. Like, they personally want this to work in a way that no VC could ever, you know, kind of personally and kind of intimately have that kind of conviction. So I was like, I think it'd be really cool to bring patients in on the cap table. But I had no idea, like, would they be interested in this? Would they be offended by this? Like, what?
It's like too much of a conflict.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to just run the experiment and be like, would this totally hit and be really cool and people would be excited by it? Would patients be excited by being given the agency to actually have a say? Like, these are real preferred shares. This is better shares than I have common. Mm. Like, every other employee, like, we all have common. Like, these are preferred shares.
Sounds like it was a hit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I was like, let's run the experiment for just like a little bit, like a few months. If it works, we'll go all in. If it doesn't work, we'll just like quietly wrap it up and kind of like just not talk about it. But it worked and people really liked it. And so it was like, now that were, and it's still going, but now that we're like on the other side of it from the perspective of like, now we definitely know that works. Now I go tell everybody about it. I'm like, guys, there's like a whole other thing you can do. I mean, you're still going to need institutional VCs.
Yeah.
This is still an expensive business. But this is like an additional thing you can do in addition to writing grants and in addition to talking to VCs and doing all the normal stuff. This is a third thing you can also do.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
More biotech should do this.
Exactly.
On the flip side, let's talk about the institutional VCs. Like,
yes.
You, in addition to Siren, obviously, you've been on a lot of scientific advisory boards.
Yeah.
Like, what have you learned about what institutional investors look for in biotech companies, especially as the market's changed?
I think there's how I would have answered that 5 years ago, and there's how I would answer it right now in like this unbelievable market that we are having called 2025.
Unbelievable. That is a good adjective to describe it.
I think it's not only are we going to see fewer companies, but those companies are going to have to be able to evolve into ones that where you can go 0 to 1, where 0 is concept and 1 is FDA approved drug in something like 4 years. And you're going to have to be able to do it for not $2 billion and quite frankly, not $1 billion and probably not even $500 million. It probably needs to be under
$100 million.
Like, $100 million, maybe even less.
Wow.
I think we're talking about like, you know, like a $50 to $100 million all in. That's all you need to go from 0 to 1. So if you think that that's true, given what's happening with AI and given what's happening with China and given what's kind of happening in terms of expectations in order to be competitive, if you believe that that is true, like what can you do as a company to get ready for that? You don't need to be ready in like 6 months, but like, it's not that far off.
Yeah.
You should probably start thinking about like, okay, what can we do to get closer to that reality now so that we're ready? And I think, yeah, it's a wholesale reimagining of, and not everybody's ready yet. Not only are the companies not ready, the people who invest in them aren't ready. I still get asked, right? I do a lot of diligence. I still get asked to like review decks where they're like, you know, review the science on this. And I'm like, okay, here's my thoughts on the science, X, Y, B, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, what are you going to value them at? And they're like, oh, well, we're going to put this number on it. And I'm like, how'd you get to that number? And they're like, oh, well, you know, we did these comps. And also we put in for our little NPV analysis, that they're going to list their gene therapy for $1 million. Everyone's still doing an NPV of $1 million. And I'm like, by the time this gene therapy is ready to hit the market, 6 years from now, there is no way on this blessed earth that it is going to get to have a list price of $1 million. None.
No one's going to pay for that.
Zero.
Yeah.
The first 20 or 30 gene therapies will get to do that, but the 300th gene therapy will not.
It has to get cheaper. Yeah.
It has to get cheaper.
That's how technology works.
And everyone's like, well, but that'll someone else's company will do that. This company won't. It's still going to have an NPV of $1 million. And you're just like, guys, your model has to change.
Mm.
So it's not just that the founders still haven't like accepted it yet. It's like all the VCs and the bankers and the private equity firms and just like the whole industry, all the vendors are still assuming they can charge X dollars amount for a bottle of media, for a GMP run, for da 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 da, because no matter what, the company can pay for it because they're going to raise $1 billion because they're going to get to list. And it's just like, no one is ready to have the conversation that like we all need to like alter our expectations.
Both speed and cost, yeah.
Speed and cost have to go down by like whole digit orders of magnitude.
I agree.
Like now. And these are very uncomfortable conversations for people to have and they're just not ready to have them. And I would argue that like that is the conversation we need to be having.
That's a very interesting one. You've been super capital efficient from what I've heard.
We're nuts.
And if I understand correctly, you are heading to the almost at the clinic. And how many full-time people do you have?
6.
Okay. That's a shockingly low number.
Yeah.
How do you do it?
I think that's the new normal, though. That's what it's going to need to be.
How does one get to the clinic with 6 people? And how can more biotech companies do that?
Brutally efficient.
Okay.
And this is not like we're just farming this in and we're all remote and everything's like we have a lab, we have people who are doing things,
mm-hmm.
But we only do things that we are uniquely qualified and like we must do. Like it has to be in-house at Siren.
What's an example of something you do that you outsource that a lot of people would do in-house? I'm guessing you're very smart about when you get a vendor to do something.
For the most part, we do things in-house that like we want to eventually tech transfer, but that we want to make sure it's perfect first.
Yeah.
And we do those things in house. And obviously any like discovery type things like that's happening. Sure. That's happening with us. But for the most part, everything else we want to outsource to a CRO, a CDMO as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. So like get it perfect inside Siren and then tech transfer it out to a CRO or a CDMO as fast as you can.
Do you think companies keep this stuff in-house too long? Like, oh, we'll get the
CDMOs
after IND.
I think they keep stuff
in-house
way too long. And I also think they try to, again, this has to do with like why we're doing a universal AAV gene therapy. They want to own everything. Mm-hmm. They're like, well, I want an in-house capsid engineering team and an in-house promoter engineering team. And I want to come up with, you know, my own electronic lab notebook, you know, because I want to own everything. I don't want to buy anybody's license for anything. And I own the whole tech stack. And you're just like, bless you. No, there are people who are much better than you at doing all of, like, let the people who are pros do the thing they're pro at. You do the thing that is so special and uniquely you. And only that, and everything else you should be outsourcing or like licensing or like getting permission from or doing a collab with or whatever. And like, don't try to be everything. Move as fast as you can in like this narrow little thing and just like get to human data as fast as you can.
What are the roles on your six person
team? So we have me, I am the only C-suite. So I'm like all the C's. Technically I'm just CEO, but I'm all the C's.
By the way, I love that because that's a ton of burn. Typically, by the time
you get
to
the... Oh, for sure. Oh, my God. C-suite. Like, they're the worst. I mean, they're the best, but they're the worst.
Live without them. Can't live with them.
Like, one of the... Like, back to the question you just asked me, like, what is a way that you can tell that, like, a company's going to succeed or fail? If I get a deck, and it's usually from the same VC firms, and I'm not going to name them. Bless them. They're great, great, great returns. LPs, continue to invest in them. But if I get a deck from, like, one of these big hoity-toity academic lab spinouts, and, like... They list the team slide and it's like a brand new, right? Like the company does not even exist yet. They are raising money to get this company started. Mm-hmm. And there's a fully built out C-suite. And they're like, here's our CEO and our CSO and our CMO and our CTO and our CPO and our CFO and our CBO. And I'm just like, what? The first 10 hires are all C-suite?
Yeah.
Before you have scientists, before you have space, before you have like even a concept of kind of what you're even doing. Mm-hmm. Why do you need a chief people officer on day one? Like much love to chief people officers. They're super important. But for like 10,000 person companies, not 30 person companies.
Sure. And then you'll need VPs and directors.
And like, you don't need any of that. And it's just like, that's one of the number one ways I know that like, oh, if this company were public, I would short them in a minute because like it ain't gonna work. Mm-hmm. Like you just don't get what it's gonna take. Same thing around like if they ask you like, oh, would you be willing to be on our scientific advisory board? And then they send you like this gift package to try to incentivize you to say yes. And it's like got like Arc'teryx jackets in it. And I'm just like, no. No, you don't get it. Like Siren didn't have merch for like 4 years.
We made
t-shirts. This is a personal fleece of mine. Like Siren did not buy this. And then we paid $20 to have it be embroidered. But like, this is my own fleece.
The swag has been done capital efficiently. I love that.
You know, like we didn't have t-shirts until like year four. And that's because we were coming out of stealth and we felt like we had to.
So you're the only C-suite. Is everyone
the
else
only C-suite.
Scientist? Or?
We have a bunch of scientists. And then we've got like one person in charge of like the two big things, which is like virus and animal studies. We've got like a director of preclinical research and we've got an SVP of like all of vector manufacturing and like that's it. That's the whole company.
And because those are things that you will like live or die by basically.
Yeah, live or die. They are absolutely like unequivocally essential to the company. And that's it. Everything else is like
tons of partners, vendors, suppliers, everything.
Yeah, everything else is like we use a consultant or a fractional this or that, or we get vendors to do stuff. We do things in collaboration with other groups. But we have six full-time people and that's all we need. It like really is all we need. Like maybe as we start the clinical trial, we'll hire one more person, like a clin dev, clin ops, something.
Someday when you're-
But like one more person.
Let's talk about the future of gene therapy.
Yeah.
You give a talk at South by Southwest earlier this year, some bold predictions that we'll all have a viral gene therapy in our lifetime.
Heck yeah.
What is the biggest bottleneck to making that happen today?
I think it's kind of a combination of what we were just talking about, that like the entire field needs to have a and not just gene therapy. I think this is all of biotech needs to have like a come to Jesus moment. Like, how are we going to exist in this modern time
where money is not free?
Where money is not free, and there are folks chasing at your heels, China and otherwise. So I think we need to get over ourselves.
So you think American R&D, just it's not even about gene therapy. It's like the whole R&D complex needs to get rebuilt.
And gene therapy is just one of the many. It's like every modality, every field, everything. We need to have this, we need to all talk. We need to all sit down in a room. Like if I had a, like clap my hands and make a wish, it would be that like we get all the CEOs and all of the VCs and all the regulators and everybody in a room that's like Chatham House rules. And it's like, guys, we got to talk. Like, you know, thermo, you can't be charging this much. And VC, you cannot be asking this much and valuing at X price. And like CEO, you know, you can't have this fully built out C-suite and, you know, whatever animal CRO, like you can't be charging this. And, you know, like we've all got to like right size our expectations and like, you know, private equity group, like you can't live for that. And like all these, like we need to all right size our expectations to something that is realistic for the moment, but we all kind of have to do it together. Cause it's one thing for me to say, well, like, I'm just going to be really capital efficient, but I can't do that if like my CDMO and my CRO are like, well, your IND enabling animal studies 20 mil. You're like, well, I have two. So, and they're like, tough cookies, right? Like, so we all need to collectively have this conversation together, and I don't think we're having it yet.
And the idea would be if timelines got shrunk and you got more medicines out, like pie gets bigger, just more more companies, smaller, more nimble.
So I think like that conversation needs to happen, and it hasn't happened yet. And then I think the next thing is we need to come up with a strategy collectively as like a United States, right? The United part of United States. We need to collectively come up with like, what is our answer for China?
Yeah. Let's talk about academia.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you first started your lab, you specifically were looking for challenges that were too long-term, too high risk for industry. That's where the idea of universal gene therapy came from. Do you believe like that early concept could have only come out of academia? Like,
particularly now, yeah, for sure. I mean, in this market, like with this macroeconomic market, much less this biotech market, there is no way on this earth someone would give you money to just kind of go tink around on something that was going to take like whole digit years to kind of see, like, does this even have legs, much less like come up with like, this is the drug and this is our name development candidate. That just kind of can't happen, and I don't think will happen anymore out in industry. You used to have like the mega rounds where you'd get this huge company and they'd announce, yeah, we just raised $400 million, and it was just like a Series B. I don't think those are going to happen. Like, you need the time that academia is in order to really flush out like the big leaps, not like the incremental things. Like, industry is great for like, we're going to take this idea and now we're going to advance it. We're going to take this idea and now we're going to advance it. So it's like these incremental things. But you kind of need the blessing that time is, that academia gives you to really like
tinker.
Just like, you know, have like you're a 1800s professor with your jacket with the leather patches, and you're just like, you're in the lab and there's classical music playing and you're just like, I am going to invent and discover and have this like this pure, unadulterated, beautiful moment.
That's a very
like,
romantic view
of
academia.
You need academia to do that. In industry, it's just like go.
Talk to me about leaving academia.
Yeah, like that's a wild decision.
It is. I'd say, especially as a professor, kind of like maybe a little less so today, but like kind of looked down upon. A little taboo. Like, how do people react when you said I'm out and doing the company thing full time?
A lot of people just were just kind of like, wait, what? Like, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you just sit on the scientific advisory board? Why wouldn't you just chair it? And keep spinning things out. Why wouldn't you?
Was that ever an option to you? Like, talk me through the decision-making process.
It wasn't. And it was a very, very, very purposeful decision. Some people can do it well, right? There are the big famous labs, the David Liu's and the George Church's and Feng Zhang's and these types of groups. There are some labs that do it well, but I think the vast majority of labs do it piss poorly. So there's, right, they are three standard deviations away from the curve. They are not the average academic lab that spins out companies. The average academic lab that spins out companies, I think, does it in a horrible way, where you have this conflict of interest situation that starts brewing, where now you've got a professor who's both spun it out and is a founder, probably sits on the scientific advisory board, obviously, might even have some interim role because they can't have a full-time role, but they could have an interim CSO or something role at the company, but they're still also a professor. And so now, like, you have this like challenge of obligations.
Yes,
where you've got
job.
Like scientists over here at the company, and maybe you're paying that scientist, you know, $130,000 a year to work on things that, like, they got to work.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot more like brutal. Like, you may not publish, you may not go to meetings and talk. It's just like, get something working and move it forward. But then you got this group over here, and these are like your students and your trainees and your technicians in these groups. And like, you might only be paying them like $40,000 a year.
Yeah.
And they need to publish and they need to present at meetings for their own, you know, career advancement and to like graduate and all these types of things. And so what do you do if you have a student who discovers something that is negative for your company? What do you do?
Yikes.
Like, that's a really challenging position to be in. And I've seen way too many times where you get professors who are like, well, let's just not present that. Let's present some of your other work. And we'll just not present that, or we won't publish that. And then all of a sudden, like, now it becomes this really, really ugly situation.
That's
and
awkward.
I've seen that too many times, and I was like, I don't want to do that. So either I'm all in or I'm all out for either one of these. And I'm not going to do both, because I think managing both the financial conflicts of interest, but also the like
emotional,
intellectual and emotional conflicts of interest, both for you as well as all the people that you're responsible to at both of those things, is not easy to manage. And I think we do a really terrible job of it in academia. And so I decided I am completely extricating myself from this, because I don't ever want to put a student in that situation.
You said being a CEO is 10 times harder than being a professor, but you have no regrets. What surprised you the most about being a CEO, like an industry sort of versus academia, especially given in academia, you had such a good view into industry through all the SAVs and things like that.
I think it was surprising to me simultaneously how it was exactly the same as being a professor, and also 0% the same as being a professor at the exact same time.
Unpack that a little for me.
Right, like, what is the job of a professor and what is the job of a CEO? Like, in ranked order of like most important things.
Okay.
Single most important thing is find money. Doesn't matter where you get it. Find money to get the science done.
Okay.
Like, that is unequivocally your job at both of those roles. How you do it and like the nuances are different, but it's just like, find the money, find it. Right? Next most important thing. Then everything else is like debatable. Is it second, third, fourth, fifth? But like the next couple of things, it's like, find the smartest, best people in the world and convince them to come work with you. And then once you've got them in your lab or in your group or in your company, right, make sure that all the roadblocks are out of their way. Is it that they need access to money or a piece of equipment or a sample, or they need a someone to talk to in order to kind of uncover, you know, like, how are we going to run the study, or you know, whatever it is, like, get the roadblocks out of your people's way so that they can do the best science ever. Go out and evangelize your story to the world and tell everyone it's the coolest science that has ever existed and it's the most important thing on the planet, right? All of that is kind of the same.
I see it.
And so I was surprised how well being a professor queued me up for being a CEO, because everyone tells you they're totally different. They're not the same. And, you know, there's no overlap. And I was like, man, there's a lot of overlap here. So that part was surprising because it was so similar. But the parts that were.
Yeah, what's been surprisingly different or hard?
You know, even from the outside, because everyone tells you like, oh, industry is faster. And you're like, yeah, of course. Yeah, for sure. But then it's a whole other thing to be on the other side and be like, oh, that much faster. Oh, okay.
Interesting. So the speed, or just like the deadline.
Yeah, just the pace at which you, not only everyone's moving, but like, I don't even think I knew how fast I could move.
Okay.
like I thought, like, oh, to do rigorous science, one must do this and this and this and then this and this and this, and this is how long that takes. And I know this because I've been doing it for years. And then you get out in the industry and it's like, whoa, you want me to do it in like 1/10 the time? That's not possible. And then all of a sudden you realize, like, no, it is possible.
Interesting. Could academia speed up?
It just needs money.
Okay.
It takes more money to do that. Yeah. It also takes like unrestricted time, not from the perspective of what we're talking about before, where it's like academia needs to be slow. That is true. It needs to happen. It needs to stay. But it was more like, right, in academia, you just have all these distractions.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
You got to teach courses and you got to sit on committees and you got to like review someone's PhD thesis. And there's just like all this stuff you got to do.
Whereas everyone at your company's same thing.
It's just laser focused. Do this one thing. And so when you don't have like all these committees and all this bureaucracy and all these layers and middle management, it's just like, no, you are just like laser focused on this one thing. And you're just all, and like, it's also, it's a team sport, finally. That was a big adjustment. Like everyone feels like they want to say that academia is like, we're in this together and the lab is working on this cohesive idea and we're putting it forward. It's like, no, it's super brutal, cutthroat, 1v1, first person shooter. Like it's, it's very individualized.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is my slice of pie. And if I have it, you can't have it.
It does feel a little more sort of zero sum in that
sense. Yeah. And then you get out in the industry and it's like, no, like we really are just like a team and like we live and die together and like we're all gonna work on this thing together. It was just so much more fun. Not just because we had more money than we had in the lab, but it was just more fun to really, really, really
be on a team, yeah.
Work together and to mean it.
I love that.
And it was also fun to be able to pay people more. Not like the snooty executives, because again, I'm the only C-suite and I don't pay myself well. Everyone in the company, like other than I think like two people makes more than me. It was fun from the perspective of like, right, you just came from a, you know, a situation where like there's strict limits on what you can pay people in academia, right? Like a grad student can make this much, a postdoc can make this much, right? This is set by federal grants
and you're paying them with federal grants. Now you're in the free market.
And now you can pay people, and it's like you could take a situation where like someone was over here and you were paying them like whatever, $45,000 a year in San Francisco, right? It's just like you need to live with 10 people to be able to even make rent. And then you could take that same person and you could move them out into industry and all of a sudden maybe you pay them like $145,000, like $100,000 more. And people say the sweetest stuff when that happens. No one's like, I'm going to go buy a Porsche. No, they're like, oh, I'm going to get my dog's hip fixed. I'm going to get braces because I've been really nervous about my teeth. I'm going to get my mom, you know, she needs her car fixed. It's just so nice to be able to pay people to like not be destitute poor the way that they are in academia here in San Francisco, where it's super expensive.
So, it was
like,
a great pitch for academia.
That was like really awesome. That was like the warm fuzzy. I was like, this is great. I like being a CEO.
Amazing. You walked away from a dream job and basically took a leap off a cliff. Were there any like risks that it's like a superpower of yours from what I can tell? Like, you know, how have you taken any big risks that haven't worked out?
Oh gosh, my anti-CV is 10 times longer than my CV.
Oh, anti-CV. I like that. I've never heard that before, but it's
yeah, it's exactly like all the things that you didn't win, all the things that you applied for and didn't get, right? The papers that you submitted that didn't go anywhere, mm-hmm. the grants you didn't get, the awards you didn't get, the whatever, like all the things you didn't get is at least 10 times, maybe 100 times longer than my CV, which like looks so shiny and sparkly and wonderful. And oh my gosh, she's achieved all these things. But it's like the number of things I have not gotten is so much longer. Like you have to have thick skin and you have to be okay with people just telling you to your face, like, this is a terrible idea. Like, I do not want to fund this grant, or I do not, you know, whatever. You know, I do not think you are ready for this award. I do not think you are ready for this plenary talk. I do not think you are ready for this grant. And just saying it with a smile and looking at you like right into your soul and just being like, no.
Maybe that's the lesson of people should, like, okay. if they haven't heard that a lot, people are not taking enough risks.
Yeah, you're not taking enough risks if you're not getting told no a lot.
Amazing. All right, final question before lightning round.
Yeah.
You know, you've talked about how like you really understand like funding founder-led companies right now, just because the level of obsession it takes to bring an idea into reality. Like, What advice do you have for a scientist who has an idea that some people are telling them are crazy, that maybe no one else wants to touch?
Yeah. I think you need to do two things, a positive and a negative thing. The positive thing, right, is kind of like we were saying earlier, you just have to get comfortable being uncomfortable. Like, you've just got to get used to the idea that, like, the vast majority of people aren't going to like your idea, and that's okay. Because if every single person you talk to is like, oh, yeah, of course, then you're...
That's also not a good thing.
That's not a good thing, because it means you're working on something boring and something incremental and something that's obvious, and you're probably going to get gobbled up, and, like, China's probably already working on it, and they're about to announce clinical data tomorrow.
Yeah.
So, like, almost based on, like, first principles, if everybody thinks it's a great idea, it's probably boring and probably incremental. So just, it's okay that not everyone is going to love the idea. You probably have to talk to at least 100 VCs before you get even one term sheet. And at best, you will get one. More likely, you will get zero. But at best, you will get one, right? So you can take all the cute books you've ever read about the past, about, like, how to raise venture capital, and you're going to get competing term sheets, and then you're going to pit them against each other and to get improved terms. No, you ain't, baby girl. No, you ain't. You're going to get zero or one. Just get the money and get to work, and you can worry about valuations and stuff later when it all works. But, like, get you a one term sheet at best, and it's going to take 100 VCs in this market at minimum. So just get comfortable being uncomfortable, and, like, it's fine. But the right, that's the angel. And then the devil side is, like, you also need to, like, talk to some people that you trust scientifically, and just make sure that the reason nobody likes it is that it's actually a terrible idea. Like, it's not possible.
Yeah.
Right. Like, make
there's
sure
a chance it actually
the, like,
is
scientific
a bad
first principles are there, that, like, you're not trying to say 1 + 1 = 3. Like, make sure you're not missing a fundamental thing, and that, and everyone's just too polite to tell you that, like, oh, that's actually not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why no one's giving you money. They're just too nice to tell you that, like, this actually isn't possible, or someone else is already actually doing it.
Okay. So if everyone thinks it's a good idea, bad. And if everyone thinks it's a bad idea, also bad.
Yeah.
So it's,
you have to, like, thread this needle.
Yeah.
It needs to be like, that is possible, but
here's what it might take.
Here's why it's going to be hard,
yeah,
right? Like, that's still fine to go after. So it's like, make sure it's not an impossible thing, but make sure everyone else isn't doing it, and, like, try to thread this impossible needle. And it is impossible. It is impossible.
That's good advice.
So, but it's okay, like, that it's impossible. So,
better to know now.
Yeah, better to know. And just, you know, yeah, just get comfortable being uncomfortable, and it's going to be okay. And it's okay if it all doesn't work. You can riff on it, and you can start something else. And, like, you know, your whole life does not have to be wrapped up into, like, this is the one company I will ever start from now until the end of time, and it will be my retirement project, and I will die at my desk. Like, probably not.
Probably,
like, you're
not
probably going to have 2 or 3 or 4 companies. Like, don't make this one crummy. Make sure it's good. But, like, you don't have to wrap up your whole self-worth.
Lower the stakes. Yeah, yeah.
Like, lower the stakes. Like, just get some, like, get cooking. Get in the kitchen. Cook. See what you can come up with. Just get cooking.
That's good advice. Get cooking.
Just get cooking.
All right. Lightning round.
Get a crack team and get cooking.
Oh, that's tech lingo.
Exactly.
All right. In your opinion, and this is lightning round, just say whatever comes to mind. Most game-changing medicine of the last 100 years.
NyQuil and DayQuil, the combo. Oh.
That's the best.
Because honestly, like, think about it. How many times have you been, like, just at your wit's end, you're so sick, but you have to work. Like, there's a deadline you can't miss. So you can't be like, oh, I'm gonna take a sick day. Like, DayQuil, NyQuil, man, that cycle of, like, 2 or 3 days of DayQuil, NyQuil was just like, DayQuil to get through the day, get home, NyQuil, and just force yourself to sleep. Like, DayQuil, NyQuil will get you through some dark, dark, dark sickness days and just, like, get you to that deadline that, like, you can't miss.
I don't know who makes NyQuil, but I'm going to hit them up to sponsor this episode.
Like, I mean, they're, like, you know, fantastic, you know, antibiotics and, you know, like, all these, like, phenomenal breakthroughs. But, like, man, DayQuil, NyQuil.
I respect it.
That is a solid.
What is something about you that people would be surprised to learn?
I don't own a single t-shirt. Siren has t-shirts. Many people have t-shirts. I don't own one. I despise t-shirts with, like, the fire of 1,000 suns because they bunch up in your armpits and they're itchy and I just can't stand it. So it's either, like, tank top or full sleeves or nothing. No t-shirts.
Okay.
You will never catch me in one.
All right.
They are They're evil.
What were you obsessed with as a child?
What was I obsessed with? I mean, probably sports, but that is probably knowable. Folks probably know that. Something that people don't know. Probably something weird. Like watermelon. So, like the watermelon that you eat. I used to enter a watermelon eating competition every summer.
Did you win?
Every year.
Wow.
Like undefeated. Like Nathan's hot dog level guy.
Wow.
But of watermelon, of like my local tiny town. So not exactly the same thing as like the Nathan's hot dog guy. I don't challenge me to a watermelon eating contest.
Okay.
I will beat you.
All right.
And this is like no hands either. Like no hands style, like behind your back.
Okay. That's legit.
I will win.
Okay. Wow.
I'm also very competitive. So even if I thought I could lose, I would still win because I will just eat until I throw it up if I have to. I'm going to beat you. I'm going to win more. I'm going to eat more watermelon.
Where's the craziest place you've been off-roading with your Jeep?
I don't know that it's crazy. I feel like it's a normal place that you would go, but probably the funnest place is just Moab. I mean, it's just like the whole city is just built for this
off-roading
kind of stuff. Whether it's with a Jeep, whether it's with a dirt bike, whether it's with a mountain bike, whether it's hiking with your feet, like that whole city is just so geared towards that. And it's also just, it's not just like, oh, here's a couple trails where we allow it. It's like, no, we have like whole trails where like, that is the focus. We want you to come. We've got obstacles and things set up for you. And the whole town is like pumped about it. The way that everyone else is like, oh, well that happens over there. We have one trail where we'll let you go off-roading as opposed to
the way
like,
of life
it is like a blessing and we want you to come. Like everyone in Moab is like, come, you know, if you build it, they will come. Everyone in Moab is just like, bring your crazy stuff, whatever you got, whatever you've, you know, gotten set up, bring it. And we want you to come. It's like Moab for sure. The best.
I love that. Who should we interview next?
Oh gosh. Who should you interview next? I don't know.
Who either has spicy takes or doesn't do a lot of interviews.
Yeah.
Or both.
Who would be spicy or doesn't give a lot of interviews or would have a really interesting perspective? I would say probably someone who would I suggest? Who would I suggest? Have you done a patient yet?
Ooh, that's a good idea.
I'm going to ask a patient.
Okay.
I'm going to ask maybe a patient next because I feel like that is a perspective, like, but like, still kind of asking them the same question. I mean, not like, tell us about your company, because I don't have a company, but like, you know, like, what would you do in this moment where, you know, the expectations are, right? Like someone who's still like in the know of like everything that's happening in China, everything that's happening with the market. So like an in the know patient and be like, what's your take on this? Like, what do we do? So like an in the know patient, I think would be a really interesting perspective that I feel like I don't hear right now. I mean, I'd love to get someone from the FDA, but like they probably can't come on camera and give a talk and stuff like that. But a patient can. It's like a very in the know patient.
I love the suggestion.
Really interesting.
That was amazing. Thank you so much.
No worries.
That's it for this episode of Transcribed. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe. To nominate future guests, drop us a note at transcribed@benchling.com. See you next time.